With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with the Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, which is sponsored by The Nation magazine. I'm Jeet here. I'm a national affairs correspondent for The Nation. This week, we're going to return to foreign policy and our frequent guest and friend of the show, Matt Duss, who has a piece in The Nation, the fall book issue, which I'm very happy to share space with him in, where he writes about Bob Woodward's book, War, which is about Biden's foreign policy. And Matt has some very interesting things to say about both Bob Woodward as the sort of, I don't know, the Tacitus of the American Empire, who's chronicling the era of the mad emperors and the actual substance of Biden's foreign policy. Listeners to the show will be very familiar with Matt's voice, and I'm always happy to have him on. So welcome, Matt.
Thanks, Jeet, and I'm always glad to be on your show and very glad to share the issue with you. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I should mention that to listeners, if you can pick up the latest edition, it is actually, the fall book issue is very handsome. It has a lot of read and substance. But in particular, like, let's talk about your review. Now, Bob Woodward, very prolific writer, you know, like famous for the Watergate investigation and All the President's Men, but, you know, has written numerous books over like the last 40 years chronicling the times. And I think that these books, and you do a very good job in the review, are not a bit like the famous Watergate reporting, which was sort of challenging the status quo or the consensus, but have a very different approach. And I think it's we're thinking about Bob Woodward as a historian or as a chronicler of modern times and the sort of issues that I think you and a lot of other people have with these books.
Yeah, well, thank you again. I mean, a couple things. One is, it's, you know, this is, it's an interesting time for the piece to come out because the book is now almost a year old. It came out last fall, you know, and I was asked to write the piece probably in the spring. But no, I'm really glad to do it because, you know, the book is about Joe Biden's foreign policy, but specifically it's about the two wars, Ukraine and Gaza. I mean, it is called War. There are other elements of Biden's foreign policy that I think would have made for interesting writing. You know, they're kind of, you know, the China policy, their kind of attempt to tee up a post-neoliberal economic agenda, which had some very interesting, you know, which laid the groundwork, I think, for a very interesting debate we're having right now. But Woodward chose to focus on, again, just those two wars. And he is extremely complimentary of the way that Biden, you know, and his team executed, you know, policy here. But let's pause for a minute on Woodward. As you said, you know, he became famous along with his partner Bernstein for reporting the Watergate scandal. He's gone on to write a number of other books, occasional pieces. He's kind of like this eminence in American journalism. But what he's become is essentially a transcriber. And I was able to find this Joan Didion essay from 1996, which I think it was really impressive because, like, it's 1996 and she already has Bob Woodward's number. I mean, and I quote her at length at the beginning of the piece. And what she says is, you know, basically what he does is just wait for someone to call him and then serve as a kind of vessel for that person's interpretation of events. He really makes no... And this is true for his subsequent books and especially for this book. Woodward really just kind of, you know, copies down what people are willing to tell him without any real attempt to interpret or challenge or interrogate what they are telling him, why they might be trying to tell him these things. He seems quite happy to just serve his role as the one who helps kind of burnish different sources, versions of events into the historical record. And it falls to others to challenge that. So that's kind of what I was trying to do with my piece is, you know, just challenge the method, first of all, before I get to the substance of what the sources were using him for.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think this is like a long-standing problem with anyone who's read those books will have dealt with. I mean, I particularly remember the books that he did at the time of the second Bush administration, where it was like very clear like who his sources were, because they're the ones who always were presented in a very favorable light. I think Colin Powell, I don't think it's any secret that he was a source for several of those books. And then also like his point of view tended to change depending on just the sort of conventional wisdom of Washington. So like in, if you look at his books on the Bush junior era, like, you know, when the initial 9/11 attack happened and there was a lot of patriotic fervor, it was a lot about like the sort of, you know, strength and steely-eyed wisdom of George W. Bush. And then later on, when things started to go like a bit worse, then suddenly the sort of critics, internal critics of the policy, are allowed to sort of launder their reputation. I don't know what you want to call it. Yeah. I mean, that is perhaps a form of access journalism, but like it doesn't, to my mind, serve the public interest very well, except in the sense of, you know, while you can now learn what certain powerful people want history to remember them for, and you can get their version of events.
Right.
So yeah, no, and I think your review does a very good job of showing why that is. And that actually, you know, brings us, you know, as you mentioned, war came out last year. Yeah, but I think like already at the time, people in the Biden administration wanted to burnish their reputation. And I think it's almost like kind of like forgotten now. But like Joe Biden himself, I think he was very convinced that his great strength as president was as a foreign policy leader. And this is actually what he wanted to run on. And there were actually like meetings between him and congressional Democrats where he was like, you know, saying like, why aren't you talking about my great foreign policy? And people were saying like, Mr. President, like all our polling shows that like this is the issue where Trump is strongest on, and we don't want to be talking about something that you're very unpopular on. So
yeah,
I mean, I think that one key aspect that comes out of this book and out of your review is that the people in the Biden administration, up to and including the president, were extremely proud of their foreign policy, and they think that this is like their great legacy, and this is what they should be get the highest prizes for.
Right, and not only that, but you know, Woodward does this really remarkable bit of editorializing at the end of the book, where there's like this little postscript where he shares his own personal view. I mean, having spent the previous 300 some pages doing next to zero editorializing or interrogation or really any thinking, he offers this kind of benediction at the end of the book saying, I believe that Biden and his team will be seen by history as, you know, having, you know, carried out a very competent and you know, courageous or whatever term he wants to use. He's just extremely complimentary. Mm-hmm. And it really just stands in stark contrast to what we've just been shown, especially in the second half of the book, as I write, you know, and I've, you know, you and I know we have some disagreements about the Ukraine policy. My own view is like, all things considered, I think they handled it pretty well. I think there's different choices they could have made. They could have leaned into diplomacy and the possibility of negotiations, I think, at various times, though I still am very skeptical that Putin was or is interested in ending the war in a way that would be remotely sufficient for Ukraine's continued independence and sovereignty. But that aside, I think we both agree that the Gaza policy was an absolute catastrophic failure. And we were saying this in real time. They were hearing from people in real time. And for, you know, even especially now, as we're almost 2 years into what there is a growing consensus is a genocide, to read that postscript to say that this was a competent and responsible use of American power and influence, which was to help perpetrate this genocide, I mean to say I reject that is too weak. It's preposterous.
No, as you say, like the book is dealing with Ukraine and Gaza. And I think it's good to separate out those two. And, you know, there have been like sort of like earlier books, The Internationalist, which basically presented a narrative that, you know, Ukraine was a kind of the redemption of the Biden administration, that you had the failure, the sort of, you know, what was the correct policy in Afghanistan, but was kind of like, you know, we can all now see it was a botched withdrawal. But, you know, like afterwards, the administration showed a great deal of competence in Ukraine in terms of, and I think we want to be fair, and I think it is worth discussing some of the strengths of Biden's foreign policy, because as you lay out, there were many things that the Biden administration did right in a very difficult situation, not just in terms of the war, but actually, I think particularly in the run-up to the war. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. And again, I mean, there are things, if we're talking about their broader foreign policy, I mentioned, you know, the economic, the effort to kind of redefine America's economic approach. I can run down a number of other things, diminishing the number of drone strikes. You know, they did attempt to bring, you know, to kind of want, in addition to the Afghanistan withdrawal, which, again, the right decision, a brave decision, even though I think it was clearly carried out, you know, irresponsibly. Another thing I also want to mention here while we're on it is, you know, their work with Brazil. I mean, the Biden team very, very likely helped avert a coup in Brazil. And I think that that's really important. I see that, and I've often brought this up as an example of how I think American influence should be used. So I do think it's worth noting. But those are outside the scope of the book, which again focuses just on these two wars. So
Yeah. And I mean, like, to talk more broadly, I mean, like, especially in light of the way the Trump administration is carrying out, and I want to especially make this clear as someone who's like been very critical of Biden's foreign policy, but the broader approach that they took with the emphasis on alliances and diplomacy was very important. And there was a sort of rebuilding of the State Department and an engagement with many countries around the world, including like India, which is like very different than the Trump approach. And, you know, like the sort of like, you know, the complete like abandonment of diplomacy and the sort of, you know, so I do actually want to say that, like, you know, like any sort of, you know, if we're trying to imagine a sort of positive role for the United States in the world, we do actually want an administration that like takes the work of diplomacy seriously. And I think that Biden deserves credit for that.
He does. And again, not to disagree with myself. Yeah, certainly Trump is taking things in a much worse direction, a much more dangerous, a much more destabilizing direction. But I think part of what the tragedy of the Biden administration is that a lot of this diplomacy, I mean, it goes back to the statement from Biden at the beginning of his administration, America is back. You know, it was based on this kind of nostalgic kind of Cold War and post-Cold War view of American power, American primacy, and the idea that we can kind of shore up and salvage this vision of America's influence in a world where that time has passed. Like, we are very much in a multipolar era. There are other rising powers. That's not to say the United States is just a power in total eclipse. We are still enormously powerful. We have an enormous, like a very formidable network of partnerships and alliances that can do a lot of good for us and for the world. And we should look for ways to help do that. But again, the good things that Biden was able to do were all seem to be rooted in this kind of nostalgic old vision of how American power should work. And thus it is very easy for Trump to simply walk in and kind of smash that down because it was based on sand. It was based on an illusion.
No, I think that is fair. You know, before we get into the Gaza stuff, like, I do want to like talk a little bit about Ukraine. Whereas you said, you know, we have some disagreements, but I think it's actually worth fleshing out what American diplomacy was able to achieve. And in particular, I mean, I do actually think Ukraine stands out because there was actually a lot of engagement with the European powers and more so than elsewhere in the world. So you want to say something about that?
Sure. I mean, let's look, you know, let's go back to, you know, the beginning, the first year of Biden's administration. You know, we knew that their focus, their obsessive focus was going to be China. It was China. China is, for the Biden administration and for Washington generally, now the lens through which everyone sees American foreign policy. Rising China, a pacing threat for American power and influence, all the things that they say here in Washington. And for that reason, Biden and his team really, they wanted to try and park the Russia relationship out of the way. Like, there was an understanding, listen, we're not going to be great friends with Putin, but we need to at least try to bring some stability and predictability to the relationship such that we're not constantly provoking each other. We should try to have some clarity at least. And that's what there was a summit about in, I believe it was June 2021, where Biden and Putin met. It seemed to go okay. And yet for Putin, clearly he was not satisfied. He did not get what he wanted out of that. Now, there are some who have said that you know, the United States should have offered more, should have said clearly, unequivocally and publicly to Putin at that time that Ukraine will not be in NATO, which, by the way, Ukraine will never be in NATO. I think we just need to say that explicitly.
Yeah.
And again, this is where I think it's fair to criticize the Biden administration. And I write about this, too, this idea that, well, we kind of know that Ukraine's never going to be in NATO, and we've been stringing them along in a really cruel and unfair way.
Yeah.
But because we are so committed to this policy of the open door for NATO, it would be wrong to say that Ukraine won't be in NATO, because that would be essentially giving Russia a veto over who gets to be in NATO. And it's like this obsessive commitment to this one particular norm at, you know, and again, I am not convinced that even had they said that publicly, that that would have been enough for Putin. I think from what he has said and written and done, his kind of goals and grievances and vision for, you know, Russia's natural historic rights in its near abroad and in, you know, its role on the global stage as a great power standing alongside great powers like the United States and China, I don't think that just withdrawing the NATO possibility from Ukraine would have been enough. However, I think in retrospect, it would have been worth a try, if only to call his bluff. I think it's worth doing now, which Trump is essentially making clear. And we all see it's not really getting Putin to a place where he's ready to end the war. But still, if it was possible to try and avert this catastrophic war that began in 2022, I think it would have been worth a try. But after that summit, you know, you saw, you know, Russia begin to mass its forces on the borders of Ukraine and Belarus and Russia. And then you had a pretty intensive, you know, flurry of trips from U.S. officials, Bill Burns, who was the head of the CIA, but who I joke was the actual Secretary of State. Like when you want someone to actually try and negotiate, you send Bill Burns. When you want someone to give a speech, you send Tony Blinken. You know, you also had, you know, German Chancellor Scholz. You had Emmanuel Macron of France all going to meet with Putin, to sit around that long table, if you remember those pictures, like, yes, you know, still post-COVID Putin, you know, who that ridiculous huge long table with them. Yeah. And then they would come out of those meetings and give press conferences to say, like, we are trying to address Putin or Russia's very legitimate security concerns. You know, and for me, and I think for most people who kind of understand diplo speak, that was pretty clear code for, you know, we understand Putin is, you know, concerned about Ukraine being in NATO, and that's not going to happen. As I write in the piece, and, you know, in the review of the Woodward book, you know, Boris Johnson, the then Prime Minister of the UK, writes, you know, says privately, okay, we've kind of trapped ourselves, you know, because of this thing where we know Ukraine's not going to be in NATO, but we can't say it publicly. And it's like, well, who trapped you there? you've decided that you are trapped there for these weird, you know, reasons. But
I mean the whole like refusal to say that Ukraine will not be in NATO seems like, I don't actually like understand it, because I mean, if that is your actual policy, then I actually think that there's like real value, whether it deters Putin or not, like, for actually like laying that out so everybody understands that. And it's actually, as you said, like, it's actually cruel, like, to like offer the Ukrainians this kind of like hope that you will never deliver. And like, obviously, you know, like, Russian crimes against Ukraine are like horrific and terrible, but like the role of the West in like putting Ukraine in this position, to my mind, like, never like seemed to make either strategic sense. It was certainly like also seemed like morally like really offensive.
Yeah, both Georgia and Ukraine, you know, hung out to dry because of George Bush's, you know, decision to announce this in the Bucharest conference. I think it was 2007, 2008. And immediately, and Bill Burns himself, who was in the State Department at that time, has written his really excellent book about, you know, what a bad decision that was. We essentially have strung both of these countries along. And obviously, Georgia suffered the consequences much, much earlier with Russia's war on Georgia. But, you know, it came around for Ukraine as well. But, you know, having said that, you know, you had these efforts to avert the war. It was insufficient. You had the decision to, you know, strategically declassify intelligence by the Biden administration, which I do think was a pretty interesting and effective policy here, just to make sure that Russia would not be able to kind of create a false pretext, you know, to say that, oh, we've been attacked or something happened and therefore we need to move our troops. And so it made very, very clear to the world that this was an aggressive act of war by Russia. And I think that that helped maintain unity among U.S. and Europe, and at least make clear to the rest of the world, even if there was very little success at bringing the rest of the global majority along to support the U.S.-European effort to defend Ukraine or to assist in Ukraine's own defense, precisely because they knew that, okay, all of a sudden you're committed to the rules-based order and all these norms, which, you know, we've watched you break these norms and apply double standards in our countries and all around us for these past decades. And then, of course, you saw that double standard demonstrated as explicitly as one can possibly imagine with the war in Gaza, right? Where all of, like, literally the same methods of attacks on civilians, cutting off food, water, electricity to civilian populations that were condemned, correctly condemned, as unacceptable acts and war crimes when Russia did it to Ukraine, are all of a sudden just fine and just part of this horrible war when Israel does it to Gaza.
Yeah, no. I mean, it does seem like if you take the two wars and put them together, there's at the very least a sort of contradiction in the policies. I mean, at the time, I remember thinking that basically, if you want to find any coherence in the policy, it is a sort of fortress Europe view of the world. Mm-hmm. That, you want to preserve the sort of civilization of Europe and the rest of the world is a jungle of which, like, no laws apply. And, like, there's certainly a view that at least some European leaders have articulated. But I actually think, like I don't know why people in the United States would want to support that view of the world. And I certainly don't know why, like, you would imagine that, like, you know, the vast majority of the planet that lives outside of, you know, like, the NATO countries would think that this is, like, a foreign policy that one would align with.
Yeah, right. And they, you know, they seem to think that these kind of bold speeches and statements and rhetoric would be enough to rally the world. And it turns out that it wasn't. And again, I don't want to, every country deals in double standards. Every country deals in hypocrisies. This is the unfortunate reality, I think, of the world. But there are ways to diminish that chasm between rhetoric and action. And there seemed to be just very little acknowledgement that that chasm even existed on the part of the Biden administration. I mean, that was part of the huge disconnect, especially, you know, as I know, like, there are things that they say about Putin and his lying and his historical perspective and how Americans can't understand these kinds of things because we don't lie and we don't think in terms of thousands of years. And I was like, if Woodward was, like, a smarter, like, writer, I mean, he would understand that he is teeing up gags for the second half of the book.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the Biden administration goes on to lie consistently, in part based on, you know, Biden's own thousand-year kind of version of Christian Zionism. And Americans, many Americans, not just Jewish Americans, but, you know, evangelical Americans who form the largest part of the pro-Israel lobby, who very much do see these things in thousand-year terms.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, like, and it's important to emphasize this sort of emotional basis for this foreign policy, which, you know, like, to my mind, is very difficult to find a rationale, like, along strategic reasons. Now, so as you mentioned, like, Joe Biden, his larger view of the world was a nostalgic one, a kind of, like, you know, America's back. And, like, this is, you know, like, a very old man who was, like, really formed in the sort of Cold War, who is himself older than NATO. I mean, Joe Biden was, like, you know, like, remembers a time when NATO did not exist.
Yeah.
And so for whom, like, all that sort of Truman, Acheson, present at the creation, you know, like, America as a sort of, you know, global hegemon remaking the world, like, that is very strong and present. And who, in the case of the Middle East, seems to have formed a particular emotional attachment in the early 1970s when he was first a senator, which he talks often about, meeting Golda Meir.
Incessantly, constantly.
Yeah. So, I mean, you say Christian Zionism, and I think for many listeners, people, you know, there's obviously a form that is coming from the right, which people are very familiar with, which actually I almost think is, like, almost, like, under-talked about now, considering that Huckabee is the ambassador there and is, like, you know, like, doing... is he like invited people to bring over like red calves or something like this? Like
yeah, they're out there looking for it. They're trying to breed it.
So for listeners, this is like the view that the final apocalypse and the return of Jesus Christ will come with the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem and red calves, as in the Book of Revelation, which would be like kind of unhinged, except that this is what the American ambassador to Israel believes and is very interested in promoting. But I mean, since Trump was president, I think that sort of Christian Zionism is should be talked about more. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also very important to understand that there's a form of Christian Zionism that exists among liberals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one sees us in, you know, Chuck Schumer, the leading Democrat in the Senate, who talks about, well, you know, like it's Israel's land because the Torah says so. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, Bill Clinton, who went to Michigan right. in the lead up to the election and said that, described the land as Judea and Samaria, like, you know, using the biblical terminology, and saying it was given to King David. So, like, to the extent to which this sort of ethno-nationalist reading of history, and I just want to also underscore something, because, you know, like, obviously it's a religious point of view, but it's also like a really modern religious point of view. Mm. Like, in neither Judaism nor in Christianity do you see people before the 19th century talking like in terms of the Bible as a warrant for an ethno-nationalist state. Like, that is like...
Right. I mean, a couple of points in there. One is, I mean, first, I mean, Chuck Schumer is just, you know, he's not a Christian Zionist, obviously. Just a Zionist.
But he has a religious understanding of Zionism.
Right, right. I think that's right. But that's what I also want to say. Like, you're right that the modern Zionism as we know it, I mean, there has been a kind of, you know, desire to return to Israel that's been part of Judaism since, you know, the exile. But it's, you know... Zionism as a modern political ideology came up when nationalism came up. It is a modern construct because nationalism is a modern construct. But I think you're right to bring up Bill Clinton along with Joe Biden, because they would not necessarily, I think, define themselves as Christian Zionists in the way that, of course, John Hagee and the kind of very, very right wing, you know, the Mike Huckabee and the you know, pre-millennial dispensationalists, all that kind of stuff, like the hardcore chapter and verse. But, you know, as a Catholic in Biden's case, a Southern Baptist in Clinton's case, they are, and I'll speak for myself as well as someone who grew up in the evangelical church. I mean, there is just an understanding of the history of Israel and the Jewish people, you know, from our shared religious upbringing. The Old Testament is part of the Christian Bible. And so there is an affinity, or at least an understanding, of one of these people's narratives, the Jewish narrative, that we just simply do not have, or many Americans, Christian Americans, simply don't share or not exposed to when it comes to Palestinians. Mm. So even for people who are not acting out of any kind of bad will, they're just starting from a place of, well, I'm familiar with this one story. I know nothing about this other story. And I think that partially helps explain U.S. policy. But also we see from Clinton and Biden, just the way they talk about it, clearly this informs a very particular understanding. You know, it's a kind of 60s Leon Uris Exodus understanding of the inspiring story of the creation of Israel, where, you know, the Palestinians and the Arabs are basically just villains or you know, people who were somehow in the way. And that it's just a complete identification and romanticization of this one side of the story with very little, you know, barely even any lip service to the other side.
Yeah, no, I think that comes out very well in your review of the Woodward book, where was that like one quote from Biden about the Palestinians, never crucify yourself over something small, or
right, never crucify yourself on a small cross. This is something, Peter Beinart got this. Actually, no, this was taken, I believe, from Michael Oren's memoir. Michael Oren, Israeli historian who then went on to be the Israeli ambassador to the United States, who wrote one good book about, I believe, the 1967 war, and then written a bunch of really, really horrible books. But he quotes Biden in having said that. And the point of it is Biden just doesn't see the Palestinian issue as worth the time and trouble.
Yeah.
And, you know, that quote is horrible just in itself, but I've often wondered how small that cross looks to Biden now, you know, given that his presidency was nailed to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is the case, though, that like Biden was willing to sacrifice his presidency in order to support Benjamin Netanyahu. And like from the book, Woodward book, and your sort of analysis of it, it does seem like they had a bunch of different rationalizations that we've established that they're coming, Biden in particular is coming from this sort of very 1960s Leon Uras sort of liberal Zionism, which he's like unwilling to like rethink or change in the light of subsequent facts. They're also aware that Israel was doing in Gaza was not good, but they actually had some rationale for their policy, thinking that it was actually going to have some sort of effect or change Benjamin Netanyahu's behavior. So what were the ways in which they conceptualized what they were doing?
Yeah. Well, I wrote a piece in Foreign Policy a couple months ago, basically confronting all those arguments, which I think are nonsense, but I'll just tick through them. One is, We can't block arms. We can't withhold arms to Israel because that would be an incentive for Hezbollah and Iran to kind of escalate their attacks, which I think it should be abundantly clear. And it was certainly abundantly clear to Hamas's great disappointment that Hezbollah and Iran were not interested in getting into this war. So the idea that all of a sudden they would be like, surprise, we're now interested if the United States, used withholding of weapons to pressure Netanyahu to wind the war down. No, I think, frankly, they would have been relieved. There was, a number of other arguments they make. One of the most preposterous is that, yes, we don't like what they're doing, but we need to maintain influence with them. And we will lose that influence if we stop the supply of weapons. Now, that's, again, one of the reasons that's so absurd, and I note this in my piece, is this is literally the argument that the Obama administration made for why they had to keep arming the Saudis for their war in Yemen. Mm-hmm. And then after the Obama administration, when Trump escalated his support for the Saudi war, there was a letter written, signed by a bunch of former Obama administration officials, almost all of whom went on to serve in the Biden administration, basically saying, we thought that supplying weapons would enable us a level of influence to guide the conduct of this war. We were wrong. That was a bad strategy. We are sorry. And that's exactly the strategy they pursued and continue now to defend when they did it with Israel. But the larger point I also make is, none of that really matters, because none of that, even if that, from a policy and strategic approach made sense, that would not then justify lying about the war, lying about Israel's conduct, which they constantly did. They constantly refused to acknowledge what everyone else could plainly see. They constantly kind of clouded the issue, pretended, we haven't received an assessment yet. And let's understand, it took them 1 month to assess that Russia was committing war crimes in Ukraine. The United States has just almost total visibility on what Israel has been doing in Gaza. The relationships between our two militaries, our two governments, our two intelligence services are so tight. So the idea that it took you a month to assess this about Russia, but still, to the end of the administration, they were never able to offer an assessment is just, I'm sorry, it's beyond belief. So of course, they were committed to just protecting diplomatically, politically, Israel and the conduct of this war. And I really, it's really, to call it unforgivable is to commit, I think, felony understatement.
Absolutely. It was a complete betrayal of their sort of stated principles. Yeah. And also actually very bad for them, bad for the United States, both internationally, and bad for the themselves politically. It was just it remains in my mind baffling. This seems almost like a kind of weird disconnect. I don't want to single him out as the only perpetrator, but it is to me Matthew Miller, was a spokesperson, really illustrates this, because, you know, like, he had been, you know, on that stage, like, addressing reporters, repeatedly saying, like, well, we're waiting for more information, or we're investigating, like, these allegations of war crimes, expressing a great deal of uncertainty. And since he, like, left that post, he's been pretty frank about saying, like, well, no, Israel was committing war crimes. And I think that, like, for someone like that, like, it seems like there's a kind of maybe disassociation between what he himself said, like, maybe, like, thinking that, well, this is, I'm in a professional capacity, and like, what I personally believe doesn't matter. But, like, I actually don't understand even how that works, because if you're hired to be a spokesperson, you're actually hired to give your stamp of approval to what you're saying. Like, you're right. Supposed to believe what you're saying. You're not supposed to like, lie. Like, and that, you know, applies to, like, all sorts of professions where you're, like being a lawyer, or being a representative of public relations. Like, you're actually supposed to have professional obligation to, like, to tell the truth.
No, that you, there should be an ethical code. Now, their view, and he said this, and again, he gets a lot of attention. But let's note, he gets a lot of attention because he is thus far the only one who's been willing to cop to it.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, let's say, I don't want to single him out. And actually, I think in some ways, he's being more honest than others. But I, but it does seem like, his case does sort of indicate, like, some sort of weird disconnect between, like, personal belief and, like, professional action.
And but again, this goes, I think, to just, this is part of Washington's corruption, is the idea that, now, listen, if Matt Mill had the choice, he was being asked to lie. He could have resigned. He chose not to resign. He made a decision, well, I will go up there and I will lie. He now admits that he has lied. This is who he is now. He is a confessed liar. But he understands that because there is no such thing as any kind of real accountability in Washington, he will be just fine. That's why, again, this is, his confession is, like, is essentially part of the problem. He knows that he'll be fine professionally.
And actually, that goes into, like, I think the last theme of your book that I want to really hit on, which is that there has been no accountability. And, like, all these figures that were, you know, like, we could now say were accessories, accomplices in war crimes, in genocide, I'm willing to say, none of them have suffered any professional punishment. Jake Sullivan is, I believe, at the Harvard School. Anthony Blinken is at the Center for American Progress. There doesn't seem to be, like, any sense that what was done was wrong, or that any of these people feel they owe an accounting to the American people for what was done when they were in power.
And again, this is itself, this is part of our, of Washington's corruption. Is that there's zero accountability. Then this is what we really have to confront. As I, you know, referencing back to my foreign policy piece, I know this is a Nation podcast. I'm sorry to keep referencing it. But, like, you know, there are people who say, like, well, the real problem is Trump. We need to focus on Trump. That's where the real danger is. And I agree. Trump, it represents a danger to our democracy. But accountability for Gaza and fighting against what Trump represents, in my view, this is part of the same fight, because the problem we face here is elite impunity. This is part of what is corroding our democracy, the idea that the rich and powerful and influential get to operate by a different set of rules from you and I. And no matter how bad they screw things up, no matter how many, like, what atrocities they help perpetrate, however they, you know, when they, whether they destroy the U.S. economy and the global economy with their ridiculous gambling, they will get golden parachutes, they will get bailed out, they will get new gigs at Harvard, they will get new seats on boards of prominent think tanks.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And actually, I mean, like, there's another way in which Trump is very connected with this, which is, I mean, as we mentioned before, like, when Biden was in power, Trump consistently got better scores for foreign policy than Biden did. And it might have, his Trump's foreign policy approval has gone down, but I actually, I think it's still, like, one of the areas where he's more robust in. And I actually think, like, if you actually look at what Trump does in foreign policy, there's many similarities with Biden, particularly in with Israel, of, you know, allowing a green light to Israel, except that Trump does not have the hypocrisy. He never says, you know, we're upholding the liberal international order. You know, they changed the supposedly changed the name of the Department of Defense to the Department of War. You know, like what one sees in Trump in foreign policy is a very ugly, nasty form of neo-imperialism, but, you know, like happily asserted as such, like, you know, we're the great power and we get to blow up whichever ships that we want to. And like, it does seem like the part of the public, like if they're given a choice between a sort of hypocritical policy that talks about human rights while supporting genocide and someone who's like, you know, like just openly forthright about being a global bully, like they'll think like, well, like, let's just have the honest policy.
Or at the very least, like there was, the alternative was less attractive. Less inspiring. It was not speaking to people's actual, you know, what their what they saw as their personal needs. It was it was not delivering for them.
There was and again, like I said this at the start, but Joe Biden wanted to run on his foreign policy. Like this is like his idea. He wanted the Democrats to run, and there's like every evidence that like you know, like however horrible Trump is, like Joe Biden's particular foreign policy was hugely unappealing. It was a huge factor in dragging him and the Democrats down. And one would think that, like, you know, like a political party that is interested in winning elections would have accountability just for the sake of its own self-interest. But on that note, it's very dire, but we have to call it as we see it. I want to once again thank Matt Duss for being on the program. I will link to his excellent review of the Bob Woodward book. And actually, we'll link to the foreign policy review as well. I would encourage everyone to read Matt's writing, and I want to thank him for being on the program.
Thank you, Jeet.